Thank you for joining us for this episode of Journey Now, produced by Journey Church in Brentwood, Tennessee. For more information on Journey Church and our gatherings, visit journeytn.com.
Welcome to another Journey Now podcast. This is Kevin with my friends, four friends that I have.
Well, there are three of us, and you must love yourself.
Yeah.
No. So there are four friends.
Don't forget about the axe in the corner.
The axe in the corner.
The axe is your friend.
Okay. It's axe body spray.
Yeah. No, it's a real axe.
Yeah. Kevin, why don't you tell us why it is that you have an axe?
No, we did this last week.
We've had this conversation.
You were not here.
Yes.
Oh, we did. We covered the axe.
Yeah.
We covered
the axe. The axe,
oh,
the gun.
And the gun. Beautiful.
Okay. The Diet Coke.
Okay.
There was
awesome.
2 liters
awesome,
of Diet
awesome.
Coke in here.
And they're gone. All that's gone.
Everything's gone.
Except for the axe.
Okay.
Beautiful. I figured I'm going to keep that.
Okay.
It's firewood burning season, and that is why there's an axe in here.
Yeah, it's 90 degrees out today. Perfect.
Yes, yes. And it's supposed to be tomorrow as well. Yeah. So that's Mike.
Okay.
That's Tim.
Hey.
And that's Susie.
And there are four of us.
And there are. And I'm Kevin.
Yep, four of us.
I'm not going to
live that
down. Me and
my four friends. There are four people total in the room.
Yes.
We're counting the axe.
I'm a little nervous.
I would be too.
Yeah. Yep. Who is in here?
So look around.
I guess we have a special guest somewhere.
Yes. Uh-huh.
So Kevin.
Where are we going?
You're sporting a new t-shirt.
I am.
And I want to just comment, because obviously you can't see us. And guys,
He's...
I mean, we were voted best looking podcast by us.
Yeah.
By Garden and Gang magazine.
My four friends.
Yeah.
And, right.
And you're wearing
A
kind of cool hip shirt today, Kevin. Tell us a little bit about
that. I have
also,
been busted on by this shirt.
Also the hat. The hat is vintage. Vintage.
Is that a vintage?
It's a vintage JHS Journey High School.
Oh.
Cap. It's a cap. It's not even a hat. It's
or it could
cap.
Be it could be junior
so
high school too.
He is
or
representing
Jesus Holy Spirit.
No, he is representing the next generation, the value of the next generation.
Okay,
there it is.
So tell us about your shirt.
My shirt's black.
And, yep.
And
a shocker.
Postcard propaganda.
Yes. Which is what, Kev?
It's a band.
Well, it's a brand new band.
Yes.
Evidently, I'm going to carry this answer my own question.
Well, I didn't know how much detail are we going into.
Listen,
here?
We had this big event called Journey Fest.
Yeah. Susie's son is in the
band. And the highlight.
Well, he's not actually in the band.
He
the
just
band
plays
is the two,
with them.
Two
he was invited to play with them.
Oh. Okay.
The band is really just Luke Cooper and Andrew Buray.
Oh.
Everyone should follow them at Postcard Propaganda on the Instas.
So the drummer and the bass player
and the bass player were invited to play the live show because sometimes you have to do that.
That's how you do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You always need a drummer.
And those sweet boys wrote my son a thank you card. I just want to know. I just want people to know that there is like... The future is in good hands.
Second coming of 21 Pilots
No,
right
the future
there.
Is in good hands because... 16-year-old boys wrote a thank you card to my son for playing the bass.
Oh, my gosh.
That's fun.
We don't know if it was voluntary, though.
I mean,
I don't want to ruin
but
that moment.
It happened. It happened. And so they're being trained up in the way that they should
go. Right.
And they're going to go.
And they will not.
Be awesome.
And they will not depart from
it.
So
thank
Kevin
you.
Came sporting. So this was their first ever concert. There were probably 200 of us. Cheering and hooting and hollering. They came out in matching white, like
it
unitard
was like
things.
Duran,
can we
Duran.
Say hooting on here?
Can we say what?
Hooting.
What?
Hooting. You said hooting.
Hooting. And hollering.
Oh, okay.
It was
hooning.
Like Duran meets Men at Work vibe.
So with some Devo.
Oh.
With a little Devo. Yeah.
There was a little
it was
Devo
good.
In it.
Yeah. It was great.
Really
but all that is to say, There are ripples from this sort of bombshell in our community that now are reflected in a T-shirt that Kevin is wearing.
Right, of our leader.
Of our leader. I mean, our leader is wearing Postcard Propaganda, and quite honestly, he is Postcard Propaganda.
Yeah.
Kevin has these. Yeah, Kevin has these sayings.
Really?
You know,
this is what we're going to talk about.
Yeah, we're talking about the apocalypse, and you know. Kevin Dixon is one of the horsemen.
Today says Revelations on it.
Yeah. Yep.
Speaking of.
Revelations.
Well done.
Yes.
Two. There were two of them.
There were two. Yes. Part one and part two. Absolutely.
Yes. But with that awesome transition from
You're welcome.
Tim,
You're welcome. Yeah.
He's now holding the axe.
Swish.
We are in a series now on Revelation called, for funniest reasons, Revelation.
Yeah, just to reinforce that it's not Revelations.
Yes, we just decided to come up with the
creative
name.
We should have put the tagline, just one. Just
one. Oh, that's funny.
We still can.
Yeah.
A hashtag, just one.
Yep.
All that to say this is that we introduced it.
We did.
Or Mike did on Sunday.
I mean, it was a collective we. It was the royal we.
Yeah. Yep. And with that came a lot of...
shocking.
Information. And shocking. Trying to explain what apocalyptic literature is becomes a mouthful in and of itself.
Yeah.
And on Sunday, Mike, you kind of offloaded these eight...
I offloaded.
Yes. These eight characteristics of apocalyptic literature.
Yep. They were, first of all, they were unloaded.
Unloaded.
And then they were offloaded.
Yes. And with that came some sense of, I probably should be taking notes. And I do believe that some of the great offloading of this information was missed.
What?
In that environment.
Are you kidding me?
Because everybody really wanted to know.
Everybody
when
remembers.
When do we start talking about sermon. Dragons and horses and and the great prostitute?
Wow.
And also, when is Jesus coming back?
Yes, that too.
And hooting.
Yes.
So, hollering. Let's just start.
And propaganda.
Revelation deals in that.
It does. It's beautiful. It's not even on a postcard.
Oh, go. So what a wonderful opportunity to take a lot of the concepts we were looking at in the how to read the Bible series and apply them to this greatly sort of confusing book. And one of the things that Kevin introduced last week was the idea of genre, which is there are different kinds of literature in the Bible, and they're to be read differently. And Revelation, one of the reasons why Revelation is very easily misunderstood is because it's comprised of three different but interrelated genres. The first is that it is an apocalypse. It's that's literally the first word of the book is apocalypsis.
Which... I didn't know that Revelation is translated. I mean, isn't that word? It's the same word?
Yeah.
Revelation and apocalypse.
Yeah.
Is the same Greek word?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Literally, the word means revelation or unveiling.
Mm-hmm. Are there other apocalyptic writings?
Absolutely.
Can you just give an example of another?
Sections of Ezekiel.
Okay.
Daniel.
The end of the, kind of the mid to end of Daniel.
Mm-hmm.
There was a book that I have, I'm a little familiar with.
There's some extra biblical ones.
Oh yeah, Enoch.
Ones. Enoch.
Would be another one. They were actually really common. It's a really common literary
form. Wasn't it
like
a trend?
Absolutely.
At the time of the writing, kind of like how zombie literature is trendy now.
Yes.
At that time it was written, apocalyptic literature
because
was the
it's
way
usually,
people communicated.
Yes, because it's written by persecuted minority groups. And in this case, Israel was an oppressed minority group governed by the Roman Empire. And there were all sorts of symbols that were readily available, not just culturally, but in the Old Testament that served as signifiers for God's faithfulness to his people and the fact that he'll vindicate them through and after their suffering.
Why would oppressed people write in apocalyptic literature?
Great question.
Great question. Because apocalyptic literature in its nature takes what is happening on the earth and sort of shows behind the scenes that God is still in control, God is still on the throne, God will win in the end, and he will vindicate his suffering people.
Right.
So the unveiling or the revelation is usually of a heavenly sort of perspective on an earthly reality. And there is, and that we get glimpses of all throughout the Old Testament. There are huge sections of apocalyptic literature, and there are little pictures of unveiling or revelation where we get a behind-the-scenes view.
But why not
of what's
just,
happening.
Why not just, if he was talking about Caesar, why not just call out Caesar?
Great question, because this was resistance literature that was designed to do two things at once. It was designed to undercut the claims of the earthly powers. Daniel does this beautifully,
yes.
Where we realize that Nebuchadnezzar and his kingdom are just one of several kingdoms, and they will all be destroyed by this rock that will come and smash them all.
Yes.
But secondly, they were designed to be subversive, and not they were not overtly attacking, but they were subversively undercutting the moral and religious claims that the country or the nation was making. And
or
so we're going to see this.
That power. Yes.
So we're going to see this as we get into Babylon, which becomes this placeholder in Revelation for the Roman Empire. We're going to see two beasts that come that represent Roman imperial power and the Roman cult, mm-hmm. with all of its economic consequences and power, and that those get undercut. And we had a question that came in on the text line, mm-hmm. because there's propaganda that's used to
postcard.
Yep, that is used to like authenticate or spread the authority and beauty of the Roman Empire that gets hijacked and now is used to proclaim the beauty and glory of God. And that's a beautiful thing. Luke does this in Luke when he gives the Christmas story. Mm-hmm. There is a Lord who will bring peace, he is Savior. Those were all Caesar words. And so these aren't just random concepts. So apocalyptic literature is meant to be resistance literature, mm-hmm. that is encoded to be understood by its original audience to provide hope in the form that God has not forgotten his people. He will vindicate them in their suffering. Mm-hmm. Now, if we want to get into some of the other characteristics of apocalyptic literature,
yeah.
The biggest one, and for our purposes in Revelation, the most important one of those is that it's highly symbolic. It usually will take the form of some sort of narrative, mm-hmm. With a beginning, middle, and end, although Revelation does something called recapitulation, which is telling the same story several different ways. The thing that is beautiful about Revelation is there's actually, the second part of verse 1, there's a little verb that is speaking of the revelation that says God made it known. And the word made it known there is the word that we get from signify or symbolize. And John is conveying to us that they're just, the means of communication revelation is highly symbolic language.
Yeah, because somebody asked, how do we know it's symbolic language?
Yes.
Yes.
And there are a couple of reasons. Number one, it's because that's what apocalyptic literature does.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And we looked at the idea of political cartoons to talk about the power of symbolic language. But the second thing that we did, and the reason that we know it's symbolic language is because John specifically tells us that he's receiving this apocalyptic language in symbols.
Yeah.
It was communicated via symbols. And it obeys the conventions of other apocalyptic literature. That's been the great gift of the Dead Sea Scrolls and other ancient texts, as we realize this isn't just some standalone written in a vacuum thing. This was part of a larger thing happening, as Susie has pointed out, in Jewish culture.
So, quick question. So, if somebody's reading the Bible, right, and they read a parable, and a parable is not a true story, but it's full of this idea of, well, there was this rich man, and there was this thing, and da-da-da-da-da, and this is what happens. It's a story that plays out, but it's not a true story. It's just a story.
Yeah.
But it's to teach a point.
Yes.
What's the difference between that kind of literature, mm-hmm. a parable,
mm-hmm. great question,
and the apocalyptic story?
Mm-hmm. The parables were usually designed to produce one main point, and that point would be a point that caused a moment of crisis for the listeners.
Right.
And that moment of crisis, in Jesus's case, was whether or not to adapt the program for Israel that was from Jesus or adapt the program of Israel that was from Israel.
Right.
And so all of his parables are by Israel, about Israel, for Israel, to Israel. They're not about us, 2,000 years later, although they do have application.
Yeah, they have some good principles in
them. Yep. Yeah. Revelation is designed to provoke a similar point of crisis, but it's about fidelity to Christ and his church and the way Christ brings about his kingdom. Mm-hmm. And then the big thing through Revelation is martyrdom.
Yep.
That Jesus, the predominant image of Jesus is a lamb that was slain from straight from the Passover story. And this Jesus, when he goes into battle, is actually covered in his own blood before the battle even begins. So the way that Jesus conquers is but through being sacrificed or allowing himself to be sacrificed. And then you have this voice of martyrs who are kind of around the throne asking how long, and you realize the book later says that the way they conquer is the same way that Jesus did.
Yeah.
And so you're confronted, although the difference between the parables and apocalyptic literature, the symbols are referring to something real.
Right.
Whereas a parable, no one went out and said, okay, so who is the prodigal son?
Right.
You didn't go out and try to find,
the difference, right?
Who's the prodigal son?
Right.
The symbols are encoded to refer to real realities.
Yes, real people.
Yep, exactly, or real things that the first century audience would have most likely understood.
Been able to identify.
Isn't it also, though, a display or meant to produce worship as a form of resistance?
Oh my goodness, yes.
Because there's lots of poetry and song in there also that people...
Mm-hmm. Yes, and so the second genre of Revelation isn't just apocalyptic literature, but it's prophetic literature.
Right. But it's all meant to move the reader towards worship, right?
But
as
worship...
As a form of resistance.
But worship as enacted discipleship. So it's not just worship as, here are these great images of people singing around the throne.
Right.
But it's enacted allegiance. That's the kind of worship that Revelation's talking about. You bet.
So when we say they overcame him by the blood of the Lamb and the word of his testimony from there, that's a version of enacted discipleship.
That's right. They were willing to suffer in the face of persecution.
Right.
Right.
Exactly right. Exactly right.
And it was to stand in direct opposition to the emperor.
Right. Because that was the crisis moment, is that... Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Things were happening historically where the church was becoming more and more persecuted.
Yes.
So apocalyptic literature is usually use a pseudonym, but John doesn't. So that's one way Revelation is different. Mm. It takes a narrative form, highly symbolic language. Yep. It uses esoteric language that is interpreted by heavenly mediary. So John will interact with angels all through the course of his vision. Apocalyptic literature is very much dualistic, meaning that you have God and the good team, you have Satan and the anti-trilogy of the dragon and two beasts, and their crowd or horde, and that there is conflict between them. And you also have temporal dualism, which just means the present age looks awful. Mm-hmm. There will come a decisive moment when God will intervene. And so apocalypses are usually pretty pessimistic about humanity's ability to fix what is happening. Mm. And if you would have been under the foot of Roman power, you'd have felt the same way. Mm-hmm. Right? There's just no way a little nation in the armpit of the world would have been able to take on the Roman Empire. And yet, I mean, that's actually what ends up happening, a couple of hundred years later. But the idea was only God's intervention could produce the salvation that the people are hungry for. And then one of the things that's super interesting about apocalypse is how they view time. And time, everything is imminent in apocalypses. Everything is going to happen now. Mm. So seven times, we're going to look at it this week, seven times... Or is it five? I don't remember. I think it's seven.
What?
The phrase will soon or must soon take place. Mm. And so we're going to talk about what that means. Because apocalypses have a kind of a heaven's eye view of time that isn't as linear as kind of our view of time is. And so it's interesting what must soon take place turns out to mean and how that phrase functions in the book. But it's just an indication that apocalypses use the idea of the imminent crisis as a way to paint, the invitation to a decision point now. This is urgent, that you cannot wait. You cannot choose not to choose. The crisis is now. Yeah. So you have these beautiful characteristics that are then woven into two other genres, the prophetic genre, And just a regular New Testament letter called an epistle. Mm-hmm. And so the big things we tried to come away with was because it's apocalyptic, it's symbolic. But those symbols refer to things, absolutely. Secondly, because it's prophetic, and we looked a bit at prophetic literature, that it's concerned with faithfulness of the generation now.
It's not fortune telling.
It's not fortune telling. Never was. Mm-hmm. Now, there are times when, as a way to call the current generation to fidelity, there will be a prediction. So like we have one in the book of Acts where I think it's Agabus stands up and says there will be a famine that was going to hit the world. And then Paul goes out and starts to raise money for the poor in Jerusalem. So there are times it happens, but that is so rare compared to...
And when you're saying current, that was current at that time.
Correct. Yes. Thank you.
Around 90 AD.
Yeah.
Right.
And then as an epistle, the big thing you need to remember about an epistle is that would have made sense to the original audience. Yep. And there are five different blessings of blessed is the reader, blessed are the hearers of this prophecy. Mm-hmm. And then John even says a couple of times when he's giving it something that's highly encoded, he'll say, let the reader understand. Meaning, you guys know what this is.
Those are ears, yeah. Isn't it? Those are ears?
No, that's Jesus' way of saying a similar thing. Okay. But this is, so 666 becomes let the reader understand, meaning you guys know what I'm talking about. Hmm. And so these aren't contemporary figures that are being referenced.
They're not debit cards and chips. And
right, right. Oh. Yeah. I'm telling you, I've had lots of nacho chips and I've been fine. I don't feel disloyal to Jesus at all. Yeah. Anyway.
Ooh, I like nacho chips.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, I think we should cut that one out. We'll cut that one out of the podcast.
Okay.
That's a horrible idea. If we cut the bad jokes out, nothing is left.
So I've been watching Tim over there on his phone, swiggling his finger and doing all kinds of things.
I'm writing notes, people.
And I'm like, is there a question coming from that corner? Tim's or
I've got a question of nacho cheese.
Are we done with this segment? Yeah, go.
Sure.
Yeah. I have a question.
Are we done with this segment?
Oh, we're done.
What are you hoping we will come away with from this series?
You guys are on fire this morning.
Because, I'm just saying, I mean, I was telling you yesterday, I was driving into work and there's another local church in town, bless them, may they flourish in the name of Jesus,
amen,
who are doing a series on Revelation as well. There's all kinds of popular books are like selling right now on Revelation. There's people who are thinking because of COVID and all the things that... You know, we're in the quote unquote end times.
Yeah.
So is that why we're teaching on Revelation? Like, why are we teaching on Revelation?
Question.
And what are you hoping? Hoping we will be formed as a community?
Oh, so good, Susie. Swish.
That was for you, Tim.
Yeah, that was great.
Can you throw in a chip?
One of the things that the way I was raised was the way many of us were raised is that Revelation was a source of fear. And the presentation of Revelation in film or in music or whatever was very fear inducing, and that, you know, this man, you don't want to miss this because then think about what God's going to do to all these people who don't believe. Mm-hmm. And I've since come to believe there's been a lot of harm done with that take of Revelation. And it's exactly the opposite reaction that Revelation was trying to produce in the original audience, which was hope.
Yeah.
That even in the midst of evil and suffering that was real and injustice and all of those things, there's no naivety to this hope, that God would vindicate his people and himself be vindicated. And that in Psalm 2, it says, you know, why do the nations rage against our God? And then the rest of the psalm is this messianic picture of God being vindicated in the sight of the nations. That Revelation is almost channeling that image to provoke hope and joyful hope in the midst of the communities that were contemporary, right, to the events that were happening, that there would faithful discipleship would not be manifest out of fear, but would be manifested out of a joyful hope, and that joyful hope could end in martyrdom. But it often included economic marginalization, it included cultural marginalization and suspicion, it included very real bits of persecution that, you know, that we still see in the world and other places today. So the posture, I would love to see Revelation now inhabit its original its original goal, mm-hmm. which was to provoke a community of faithful hope and joyful hope in a world that is just going crazy, instead of it being used as a heavenly version of Santa Claus. If you're freaking naughty, this is the hammer.
Naughty list and nice list.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. It's the Lamb's Book of Life. If you're not in that, buddy, guess what? We got boils and rivers of blood for you. And I'm so discouraged by that interpretation because I just don't think it's faithful.
It's interesting too, because I think that the whole movement of fear or whatever that is evoked with that kind of take on Revelation,
yeah.
It really produces this like sense of, I need to keep a watch on everything around me. Mm. I need to be careful.
Yeah.
I need to be discerning, really even we'll use that word discerning, like look at the news, look at what's happening in the world, look at the way the generations are going downhill, like all the things. Whereas what I hear you saying, what Revelation does, it actually attempts to take our eyes and place them on Jesus and on the Lamb that was
slain.
Because
it's a revelation of Jesus.
And and so that it does produce hope, because in the midst of all of that, we're not to pay attention to it, but not be swept up in the oppression and the suffering and the damage that's being done around us, but to keep our eyes fixed, right?
Come on.
On Jesus. And
sort of comports with the rest of the New Testament.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Exactly right.
And even like the whole, I mean, people love to, I mean, I love the, I really do love the verses that say that they overcame with the blood of the Lamb and the word of their testimony, that in and of itself draws attention to the work of Christ within
Absolutely.
The community.
Yes.
And that is to empower us and encourage us and to produce hope rather than leaving us like with this like fearful, like looking over my shoulders, look around, be warned, hide your women, hide your children, stock up all the food, like all the things that often happens, right?
That's so good.
Yeah.
Great. But that's the best way to end it. That's perfect.
I didn't mean to end
it. I'm excited.
Boom.
I mean, I'm not trying to shut anything down.
I grew up with the first, thinking it's just this is a scary book.
Yeah.
Then as I went to college and started studying more and talking to some of my buddies and trying to figure some of this stuff out, it was like, oh no, it was for those people.
Right.
This isn't for us. But then it made that like, it's just a book that I will never understand because there are too many symbols. I don't get it.
Right.
And it just felt like, oh, that's just more of a history book.
Right.
That's telling the history, but it had no power. And so I'm more encouraged about, I'm excited about this whole next season trying to figure out what does hope really look like? And what is he actually saying? If it is the revelation of Jesus,
right.
How is this really more beautiful than I ever thought before?
Well, and then that reminds me, because you did this in one of the gatherings, but not the other one. Like you said what the four views are.
Yeah. Oh, I didn't do it in the other one?
I don't think so. I think you only did it in one of them.
First one.
In the first one. Mm. And so like what you're talking about, Tim, is that there are actually like different ways to view the book, right? The preterist, correct. The futurist,
historic.
Just briefly describe what those are? Because I think that will help people.
There's one more. There's four.
Yeah.
It will help people understand what framework they have already.
Totally. To oversimplify, the futurist says that from Revelation 4 onward, those predictive prophecies have not been fulfilled and are still awaiting us in the future. And that's why we should be paying attention.
Mm-hmm. The left behind, you know, that idea.
Yeah, right. Absolutely. Right. Preterist says, nope. With the exception of Revelation 21 and 22, the return and the coming of the kingdom and the great judgment, all of that was about what was happening in the first century to the first century church. Mm-hmm. There is an historicist view that says, actually, what Revelation is the unfolding from the coming of Jesus to the current day about the history of the church. Mm-hmm. So the focus of the book is the church. And then there's a view called the idealist view, which is that what Revelation is about isn't any concrete historical event, but that rather the timeless ongoing struggle between good and evil that can take many forms throughout human history. So the beast could be the Nazis, the beast could be the crusaders, whatever form evil is taking.
And are you teaching this from any one of those particular views?
No, because they all have something to commend them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we would say they're all, there are pieces of truth to all of them. Mm-hmm. But what I think they lack, and again, this isn't just Mike Erie talking. These are deep veins of scholarship that goes back 50 years.
Which we have a book list also available that shows the work.
Yeah.
Yes. It's not just Mike Erie.
Yeah. Oh my Lord. No.
We can link to that in the show notes.
But the futuristic one has become more prominent since
the 1800s.
Yeah.
It became modeled to the first sort of study Bible, the Scofield Study Bible.
Yeah.
Was the advocated in the study notes, the premillennial dispensational view.
Yeah.
And that became the predominant view in America.
Yeah.
And then it got popularized.
Not around the world.
No, but still,
you just threw out a term that a lot of people listening to this podcast are not going to understand.
Which word?
The premillennial dispensationalist view. Maybe next week we need to talk about all that stuff because, like,
you can do it quick.
Okay.
It's a quick and dirty,
But I'm just saying for.
Yeah.
The normal person.
Yeah, totally. To say that, yeah.
Like you're throwing out four different views of Revelation. And
well, you asked me to.
I know I did. Yes. I asked you to throw it out.
Yeah.
Pitch it out if you
will. Well, unload it.
But unloaded. But like off-load. These are all terms I think that are like, I mean, we almost need to have a glossary of terms.
Right.
Yeah, because they've been used oftentimes to people. People assume they know what dispensationalism is. They assume they know what the different views of the millennium.
Okay, so connect for us right now, because you just connected the futurist with the
premillennial
dispensationalist view. What is that?
Okay, the futurist view can take many forms. In America, the predominant form, it has been kind of the left behind calendarizing view of there will be a rapture.
Which also you threw that bomb out on Sunday that word rapture is not even in the book of Revelation.
Correct.
Is it in the Bible?
Well, boy, that's a fascinating. It comes from Thessalonians, and one of the parables in Matthew. Well,
25.
But that's a little apocalypse that Jesus is talking about his return. Right. But yes, it's an idea that has come from other places.
They connect those dots, though.
Yes.
Yeah.
So the one way of reading Revelation is connecting it to a timeline in Daniel, about 70 weeks, 70 weeks of weeks, or something, 70 years of weeks, or 70 weeks of years, I think is what it is. Sorry. And that Revelation is intended to give us a blueprint for how it's going to go down. And so, after chapter 4, we read these are the events that must soon take place. So. They understand that to be a reference to what's happening in the future, and then the predominant, like, there's a rapture, like there's a 7-year period called the tribulation, 3.5 years the church becomes persecuted but is raptured out, the other 3.5 years God's judgments are poured out all over the place. There is God returns. Locks Satan into prison.
Jesus returns.
Yeah, Jesus returns. There is a 1,000-year reign on the earth called the millennium.
Mm-hmm. Which is and on then the throne there of David.
And this is within that view of premillennial.
Yes.
Yes. Okay.
Yes. Yes. Do you want to answer this one?
No, I'm sorry. I keep interrupting.
No, it's okay. Please go ahead.
Go ahead.
But I'm trying to listen to what you're saying.
Yeah.
So at the end of that 1,000 years, Satan is released. There is a big battle called the Battle of Armageddon. And then God wins, and then we're at the great judgment, and there are more sophisticated forms of this. They're progressive dispensationalists, and progressive here doesn't mean liberal. It means we've moved on from that sort of view.
But that view is coming from Daniel and Revelation connected to each other.
A view, the futuristic take on Daniel and Revelation. Combined with certain other hermeneutical assumptions, has led to this popularization in Christian literature through the Left Behind series of how the events will actually go down, and so the premillennial means that the church is raptured prior to the millennial period. There are people that talk about being post-millennial or amillennial, and those have different connotations. But here's the big point that we want to make. The millennium is mentioned very briefly in Revelation 20, but there are theological systems who have based like an entire system around your view of the millennium. Mm-hmm. And this is such a great example of putting an emphasis on something in Revelation that Revelation itself doesn't emphasize. Mm. And so one of the great traps has been, and this is where we're all, you know, we all love a good conspiracy and we love the Da Vinci Code, that we just take that whole approach to the book and we see it as a puzzle that we're supposed to try to put together. And then we can have this inside knowledge that we can invite others into. And this is very popular everywhere these days, not just in Christian
circles.
Because
we're all afraid of the future.
Exactly.
Part of what has happened over the years.
Tell me.
Is the centralization of America in the story.
Yeah, one of the great critiques, that's such a good point, Kev. Yeah. One of the great critiques of that view of Revelation is it's very much American-centered.
Yeah.
And where there's just not a damn thing in the book about America.
Because it didn't exist.
Yes. And so it's very much, and where the European Union, you know, was thought to be the beast, and taking the mark would be there's a unified economy, and the failure to decode Revelation in the futurist way has really, I think, eroded. Not at a popular level, but certainly at a scholarly level, the idea that this is a credible way to understand the book.
I mean, even most recently, didn't some people think that the vaccine for COVID was?
Oh, they still do. Yeah, like absolutely.
We lost friends because of that.
Yeah,
like they thought like there would be a there's
a chip or something
that is the mark of the beast.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and it's just
legit.
It's,
people,
I believe you.
That
just makes me sad.
But when this is all you've known, and you've been told by seeming authority after authority that this is what the book is saying, it's natural to be skeptical that there's any other way to understand the book. And so we have great grace for people who were raised in that view as we were, to say, oh, I just want the only thing we're asking our community is just to have an open mind.
Right.
To consider the possibility that we haven't taken the book as seriously as we need to take it. And
that's how we lost really good friends, because they had that thought. That was their way of seeing Revelation in the whole pandemic.
Yeah.
And for us it was like, okay, great. That's fine. I'm sure you've got great thoughts, but there could be other options, other ways of seeing things. And they just couldn't see that. And so it literally had to split up a whole friendship.
Oh, man.
Which is like, oh,
oof.
Gosh.
Yeah, that's awful. Yeah. But see, no book of the Bible was ever intended to divide community like that.
Right.
Right.
Never. It was designed to create a community.
Yeah.
And a certain kind of cruciform Christ-like community. And so it just, the fear and the edge to that understanding of Revelation.
So is part of our hope as we go through this is to alleviate some of those fears, to create an idea of hope that was meant to be instilled from this book, and to bring some clarity to how the book has been mistreated over the last 200 years.
Yeah.
Or just question. It's like, it feels like it's just throwing up, like throwing up the objective flag going, let's relook at this.
Yeah. And obviously I'm convinced that it's the other way.
Right.
But I've had years to work into that conviction. Whereas for some people, this is the first time they've actually heard there's any other way to understand it.
Right.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I want to hold two things. I am passionately convinced that the fear-based way, the calendarizing way, is incorrect. And I think it's done harm. At the same time, I realized, because I was raised in that and was fascinated by it. I remember in college reading Hal Lindsey's, you know, late great Planet Earth and all this stuff, and going, oh my goodness, this is incredible.
Yeah.
And it's happening right before our eyes. But coming out of that, to experience the book as, you know, not because I want it to be different, because I genuinely believe that the goal of the book is to provoke the opposite reaction that, you know, got provoked in American culture. I want to be super gracious to people who have loads and loads and loads of questions, but I also don't want to minimize. I don't think this is one option among many. I think this is the better way to understand the book. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Yes.
So that both are true. And so, yes, Kevin, I think we want, and some people, I mean, Tim, it's so unfortunate, but I get it. Some people aren't able to live in that, and okay. Yeah. But we think that, and this gets into a bigger problem that I'd love to talk about someday on the podcast. People come into churches now not to have their assumptions examined by the Bible, but they come into church to have their assumptions confirmed.
Right. Yeah.
And we're all guilty.
Yeah.
But the we've been so discipled in a political kind of environment that we simply come in having fully formed, whether they're well formed, but they're certainly fully formed opinions on everything from sexuality and gender and immigration and race and all the really polarizing topics of the day. And we're just looking for a church that sort of agrees or disagrees with mm-hmm. those. And what we're suggesting is...
Because they would speak the truth.
Right, right. And what we want to suggest is, no, we think the role of the community is to keep us perpetually curious about the assumptions we're carrying so that they are investigated by the scripture rather than vice versa.
Yeah.
And so this is a great example of where we're trying to practice this.
Right.
Yes. Wow. That was a good discussion. Thanks, Mike. Thanks for bringing that to the table. Thanks, Tim. Thanks, Susie. Thanks, Axe in the Corner.
Yeah.
And we will
Kevin
be back
and my
next
four
week.
Friends.
Yep, Kevin and my four friends.
If you have any questions, you can email them to kirk@kirkcameron.org. If you enjoyed today's episode, we would love it if you would share a screenshot of this episode to your Instagram story and tag us at @journey_TN. And don't forget to subscribe and leave us a review on your favorite podcasting app.